Chapter 99. The chief features of which will be found to be an authentic version of the legend of Prince Bladud, and a most extraordinary calamity that befell Mr. Winkle, as Mr. Pickwick contemplated a stay of at least 2 months in Bath. He deemed it advisable to take private lodgings for himself and friends for that period, and as a favorable opportunity offered for their securing, on moderate terms, the upper portion of a house in the Royal Crescent, which was larger than they required, Mr. and Mrs. Dowler offered to relieve them of a bedroom and sitting room. This proposition was at once accepted, and in 3 days' time they were all located in their new abode, when Mr. Pickwick began to drink the waters with the utmost assiduity. Mr. Pickwick took them systematically. He drank a quarter of a pint before breakfast, and then walked up a hill, and another quarter of a pint after breakfast, and then walked down a hill, and, after every fresh quarter of a pint, Mr. Pickwick declared, in the most solemn and emphatic terms, that he felt a great deal better, whereat his friends were very much delighted, though they had not been previously aware that there was anything the matter with him. The great pump room is a spacious saloon, ornamented with Corinthian pillars, and a music gallery, and a Tompion clock, and a statue of Nash, and a golden inscription, to which all the water drinkers should attend, for it appeals to them in the cause of a deserving charity. There is a large bar with a marble vase, out of which the pumper gets the water, and there are a number of yellow-looking tumblers, out of which the company get it, and it is a most edifying and satisfactory sight to behold the perseverance and gravity with which they swallow it. There are baths near at hand, in which a part of the company wash themselves, and a band plays afterwards, to congratulate the remainder on their having done so. There is another pump room, into which infirm ladies and gentlemen are wheeled, in such an astonishing variety of chairs and chaises, that any adventurous individual who goes in with the regular number of toes, is in imminent danger of coming out without them. And there is a third, into which the quiet people go, for it is less noisy than either. There is an immensity of promenading, on crutches and off, with sticks and without, and a great deal of conversation, and liveliness, and pleasantry. Every morning, the regular water drinkers, Mr. Pickwick among the number, met each other in the pump room, took their quarter of a pint, and walked constitutionally. At the afternoon's promenade, Lord Mutant, and the Honorable Mr. Crushton, the Dowager Lady Snuffenuff, Mrs. Colonel Wugsby, and all the great people, and all the morning water drinkers, met in grand assemblage. After this, they walked out, or drove out, or were pushed out in bath chairs, and met one another again. After this, the gentlemen went to the reading rooms, and met divisions of the mass. After this, they went home. If it were theater night, perhaps they met at the theater. If it were assembly night, they met at the rooms. And if it were neither, they met the next day. A very pleasant routine, with perhaps a slight tinge of sameness. Mr. Pickwick was sitting up by himself, after a day spent in this manner, making entries in his journal, his friends having retired to bed, when he was roused by a gentle tap at the room door. "Beg your pardon, sir," said Mrs. Craddock, the landlady, peeping in. "But did you want anything more, sir?"
"Nothing more, ma'am," replied Mr. Pickwick.
"My young girl is gone to bed, sir," said Mrs. Craddock, "and Mr. Dowler is good enough to say that he'll sit up for Mrs. Dowler, as the party isn't expected to be over till late. So I was thinking that if you wanted nothing more, Mr. Pickwick, I would go to bed."
"By all means, ma'am," replied Mr. Pickwick.
"Wish you good night, sir," said Mrs. Craddock.
"Good night, ma'am," rejoined Mr. Pickwick.
Mrs. Craddock closed the door, and Mr. Pickwick resumed his writing. In half an hour's time the entries were concluded. Mr. Pickwick carefully rubbed the last page on the blotting paper, shut up the book, wiped his pen on the bottom of the inside of his coat tail, and opened the drawer of the inkstand,
to put it carefully away. There were a couple of sheets of writing paper, pretty closely written over, in the inkstand drawer, and they were folded so that the title, which was in a good round hand, was fully disclosed to him. Seeing from this that it was no private document, and as it seemed to relate to Bath, and was very short, Mr. Pickwick unfolded it, lighted his bedroom candle, that it might burn up well by the time he finished, and drawing his chair nearer the fire, read as follows, "The true legend of Prince Bladud, less than 200 years ago, on one of the public baths in this city, there appeared an inscription in honor of its mighty founder, the renowned Prince Bladud. That inscription is now erased. For many hundred years before that time, there had been handed down, from age to age, an old legend, that the illustrious prince being afflicted with leprosy, on his return from reaping a rich harvest of knowledge in Athens, shunned the court of his royal father, and consorted moodily with husbandmen and pigs. Among the herd, so said the legend, was a pig of grave and solemn countenance, with whom the prince had a fellow feeling, for he too was wise, a pig of thoughtful and reserved demeanor, an animal superior to his fellows, whose grunt was terrible, and whose bite was sharp. The young prince sighed deeply as he looked upon the countenance of the majestic swine. He thought of his royal father, and his eyes were bedewed with tears. This sagacious pig was fond of bathing in rich, moist mud. Not in summer, as common pigs do now, to cool themselves, and did even in those distant ages, which is a proof that the light of civilization had already begun to dawn, though feebly, but in the cold, sharp days of winter. His coat was ever so sleek, and his complexion so clear, that the prince resolved to essay the purifying qualities of the same water that his friend resorted to. He made the trial. Beneath that black mud, bubbled the hot springs of Bath. He washed, and was cured. Hastening to his father's court, he paid his best respects, and returning quickly hither, founded this city and its famous baths. He sought the pig with all the ardor of their early friendship, but, alas, the waters had been his death. He had imprudently taken a bath at too high a temperature, and the natural philosopher was no more. He was succeeded by Pliny, who also fell a victim to his thirst for knowledge. This was the legend. Listen to the true one. A great many centuries since, there flourished, in great state, the famous and renowned Ludhudibras, king of Britain. He was a mighty monarch. The earth shook when he walked, he was so very stout. His people basked in the light of his countenance, it was so red and glowing. He was, indeed, every inch a king. And there were a good many inches of him too, for although he was not very tall, he was a remarkable size round, and the inches that he wanted in height, he made up in circumference. If any degenerate monarch of modern times could be in any way compared with him, I should say the venerable King Cole would be that illustrious potentate. This good king had a queen, who 18 years before had a son, who was called Bladud. He was sent to a preparatory seminary in his father's dominions until he was 10 years old, and was then dispatched, in charge of a trusty messenger, to a finishing school at Athens, and as there was no extra charge for remaining during the holidays, and no notice required previous to the removal of a pupil, there he remained for 8 long years, at the expiration of which time, the king his father sent the Lord Chamberlain over, to settle the bill, and to bring him home, which, the Lord Chamberlain doing, was received with shouts, and pensioned immediately. When King Lud saw the prince his son, and found he had grown up such a fine young man, he perceived what a grand thing it would be, to have him married without delay, so that his children might be the means of perpetuating the glorious race of Lud, down to the very latest ages of the world. With this view, he sent a special embassy, composed of great noblemen who had nothing particular to do, and wanted lucrative employment, to a neighboring king, and demanded his fair daughter in marriage for his son, stating at the same time that he was anxious to be on the most affectionate terms with his brother and friend, but that if they couldn't agree in arranging this marriage, he should be under the unpleasant necessity of invading his kingdom and putting his eyes out. To this, the other king, who was the weaker of the two, replied that he was very much obliged to his friend and brother for all his goodness and magnanimity, and that his daughter was quite ready to be married, whenever Prince Vlad'd like to come and fetch her. This answer no sooner reached Britain, than the whole nation was transported with joy. Nothing was heard, on all sides, but the sounds of feasting and revelry except the chinking of money as it was paid in by the people to the collector of the royal treasures, to defray the expenses of the happy ceremony. It was upon this occasion that King Lud, seated on the top of his throne in full council, rose, in the exuberance of his feelings, and commanded the Lord Chief Justice to order in the richest wines, and the court minstrels an act of graciousness which has been, through the ignorance of traditionary historians, attributed to King Cole, in those celebrated lines in which his majesty is represented as, calling for his pipe, and calling for his pot, and calling for his fiddlers three. Which is an obvious injustice to the memory of King Lud, and a dishonest exaltation of the virtues of King Cole. But, in the midst of all this festivity and rejoicing, there was one individual present, who tasted not when the sparkling wines were poured forth, and who danced not when the minstrels played. This was no other than Prince Vlad'd himself, in honor of whose happiness a whole people were, at that very moment, straining alike their throats and purse strings. The truth was, that the prince, forgetting the undoubted right of the minister for foreign affairs to fall in love on his behalf, had, contrary to every precedent of policy and diplomacy, already fallen in love on his own account, and privately contracted himself unto the fair daughter of a noble Athenian. Here we have a striking example of one of the manifold advantages of civilization and refinement. If the prince had lived in later days, he might at once have married the object of his father's choice, and then set himself seriously to work, to relieve himself of the burden which rested heavily upon him. He might have endeavored to break her heart by a systematic course of insult and neglect, or, if the spirit of her sex, and a proud consciousness of her many wrongs had upheld her under this ill treatment, he might have sought to take her life, and so get rid of her effectually. But neither mode of relief suggested itself to Prince Vlad'd, so he solicited a private audience, and told his father, "It is an old prerogative of kings, to govern everything but their passions." King Lud flew into a frightful rage, tossed his crown up to the ceiling, and caught it again, for in those days kings kept their crowns on their heads, and not in the tower, stamped the ground, rapped his forehead, wondered why his own flesh and blood rebelled against him, and, finally, calling in his guards, ordered the prince away, to instant confinement in a lofty turret, a course of treatment which the kings of old very generally pursued towards their sons, when their matrimonial inclinations did not happen to point to the same quarter as their own. When Prince Vlad'd had been shut up in the lofty turret for the greater part of a year, with no better prospect before his bodily eyes than a stone wall, or before his mental vision than prolonged imprisonment, he naturally began to ruminate on a plan of escape, which, after months of preparation, he managed to accomplish, considerately leaving his dinner knife in the heart of his jailer, lest the poor fellow who had a family should be considered privy to his flight, and punished accordingly by the infuriated king. The monarch was frantic at the loss of his son. He knew not on whom to vent his grief and wrath, until fortunately bethinking himself of the Lord Chamberlain who had brought him home, he struck off his pension and his head together. Meanwhile, the young prince, effectually disguised, wandered on foot through his father's dominions, cheered and supported in all his hardships by sweet thoughts of the Athenian maid, who was the innocent cause of his weary trials. One day he stopped to rest in a country village, and seeing that there were gay dances going forward on the green, and gay faces passing to and fro, ventured to inquire of a reveler who stood near him, the reason for this rejoicing. Know you not, O stranger, was the reply, of the recent proclamation of our gracious king?
Proclamation. No. What proclamation?
Rejoined the prince, for he had traveled along the by and little frequented ways, and knew nothing of what had passed upon the public roads, such as they were.
Why, replied the peasant, the foreign lady that our prince wished to wed is married to a foreign noble of her own country, and the king proclaims the fact, and a great public festival besides. For now, of course, Prince Bladud will come back and marry the lady his father chose, who they say is as beautiful as the noonday sun.
Your health, sir.
God save the king. The prince remained to hear no more. He fled from the spot and plunged into the thickest recesses of a neighboring wood.
On, he wandered, night and day, beneath the blazing sun and the cold pale moon, through the dry heat of noon and the damp cold of night, in the gray light of morn and the red glare of eve. So heedless was he of time or object that, being bound for Athens, he wandered as far out of his way as Bath. There was no city where Bath stands then. There was no vestige of human habitation, or sign of man's resort, to bear the name, but there was the same noble country, the same broad expanse of hill and dale, the same beautiful channel stealing on, far away, the same lofty mountains which, like the troubles of life, viewed at a distance, and partially obscured by the bright mist of its morning, lose their ruggedness and asperity, and seem all ease and softness. Moved by the gentle beauty of the scene, the prince sank upon the green turf, and bathed his swollen feet in his tears. Oh, said the unhappy Bladud, clasping his hands, and mournfully raising his eyes towards the sky, would that my wanderings might end here. Would that these grateful tears with which I now mourn hope misplaced, and love despised, might flow in peace forever.
The wish was heard. It was in the time of the heathen deities, who used occasionally to take people at their words, with a promptness, in some cases, extremely awkward. The ground opened beneath the prince's feet, he sank into the chasm, and instantaneously it closed upon his head forever, save where his hot tears welled up through the earth, and where they have continued to gush forth ever since. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.